My name is Rich Kemmerer, and I am an artist. Now, the problem, once you have said that, is that that art really is, at least historically, about just about everything else but art. And so if you're an artist, you are about all kinds of other things. You are about society, you are about theology, you are about sex, you are about a wide range of things, whatever your subject matter leads you into. What I am about as an artist is primarily the church. And that, of course, leads you in all other directions too. And we will go far afield this week. I should tell you that I have never studied at a seminary, which I have found to be a real blessing for a lot of reasons. First of all, it lets me say outrageous things and people can just either accept them or reject them and just simply say, well, he's never studied at a seminary, so what does he know? You know, and he's just an artist. At the same time, I also I studied maybe more theology than most seminary students because I am also a PK. For those of you that don't know what a PK is, it's a pastor's kid, and anything you have heard about pastor's kids, as far as their reputation, is tame compared with the examples I set in the slums of St. Louis, which I don't want to go into now, but some of that also probably creeps into my art. We're going to be looking at this screen for the rest of the morning.
We're not.
No, that's why I say we are. The thing that I would like to share with you has to do with, and this will happen through the week, I will be making a work of art during the week, and hopefully before it's time for me to go, we'll tack it up in the village center. I want to do a 60-foot long mural on the village prayer, the Holden prayer. And we'll just lay that on the railing of the balcony in there, and then when I'm gone, they'll take it down, that's good. But it's important for us to have at least a few ideas about the visual, because the church and even our education system never pushed the use of our eyes very much. I'm afraid to throw statistics out because you can take statistics and prove just about anything that you want, but it is a fairly common statistic that by far, and some people have said as much as 80% of what we as individuals know to be true, we have learned through our eyes and not through our ears. Now that's kind of a shock, because the business of the church is so terribly much a verbal business, a word-making enterprise, that somehow I think we have gotten accustomed to justifying or proving or giving evidence of our faith verbally, and just simply canceled all other possibilities. Well, Martin Luther was perfectly right in asking, what does this mean? But he screwed everything up by answering it. So that if you want to, you know, if from now on, if if you're given a question and it is, what does this mean? You know exactly what to say. You say what Martin Luther said. I believe that I cannot, by my own reason or strength, believe in Jesus Christ my Lord. I come to him with the Holy Ghost, call me by the gospel, enlighten me with the gift, sanctify and kept me in the one true faith. Luther said that, and that is what it means. To give account of the hope that is in you means to give a verbal account whether you're good at speech or not. And so the imaging comes off kind of either as hobby or horseplay, and it really doesn't take on the same credentials as does the visual image. But as an artist and not as a theologian, when God said, let us make folks in our own image, I don't think he was saying, let's make people that talk a lot. I think what God was saying is, let's make folks that reveal to the world what God has in mind for creation. I believe that Christians ought to look different than other folks. I don't mean, you know, with the neon light behind the head and six inches off the ground, kind of hovering and changing their outfits every 5 minutes like they do in the cathedral film Life of Jesus film strips, you know. That guy had somebody taking care of his hair. Not that kind of look. I don't mean that. I mean that if Christians give an account of the hope that is in them, and it is a verbal account, somehow that ought to coincide with a different look that people do to accommodate a different statement of faith. Christians say, we are in the world, but not of. What does that look like? Shouldn't that actually look like something? If in order to be a Christian all you have to do is say you are a Christian, then obviously the whole thing is very easy, too easy. And that's been taken care of scripturally. Not everyone that says, Lord, Lord, is going to enter the kingdom of heaven. But he that does the will does the will. There's a look to doing. One of the problems with that is like Gandhi is said to have set the Christian religion back 200 years in India because he did the most Christian things, but he talked a lot about the cow. You know, had this thing for cows. And people were saying, my gosh, Christianity doesn't look any different than what Gandhi looks like. That's kind of neat. We find, if you're concerned about imaging, that very often the image of the Christian life is a much more ecumenical kind of thing than the verbalizing of the Christian life. The word tends to separate and build walls. It can. Doesn't have to, but it can. Image tends to incorporate, tends to a bit more. Well, I want to talk to you very briefly about creativity as a response to creation, which Elmer has been talking about in days past. And I want to look at creation from a slightly different angle. And once again, I hope that you'll forgive my laughter or my foolishness. I don't laugh at things that I'm not really very fond of. My laughter is, those are the points at which I am getting very serious. The whole bottom line of our getting together then for this one session is to encourage you first to look at what's going on. Some of you going to Heart Lake tomorrow? Huh? Want to take that hike? It's a great hike. No problem. But look, don't worry about your legs. It's just going to start right out, the first step. You're going to say, oh, am I going to make it? And in the whole process of that, you'll forget your eyes. Look, there is so much to see. But don't just look. Respond. Respond. Share with somebody on the trail what you're looking for. They'll think you're nuts, you know. But ask somebody to share an image. That's the blessing of the fawns. A whole community with a common image now of nesting birth. So come and share what you've got. Share that excitement. And if you've got any gumption at all, make a mark that will remind you of what it is you saw. Make a mark, just a mark. You're used to it, but all your marks so far are words. They're just verbal. Make a mark that is somehow a curve. A little curve, a shoot. You know, a little circle, like a nest, something like that. There is supposed to be a year. I don't know whether it was right with our kids, but a year at which children all say exactly the same word, and it's only one word that they say for a whole year, and the word is why. What year is that? I don't know what it, you know, it's kind of young, and it's one of the first words kids, and after a year of that, you just want to hit them right upside the head. Or somebody says, why? Your response is either ask your mother or go to your room. I guess maybe I am a little slow. I think the word is retarded. Because I'm still saying it, and I haven't gotten any good answers. I still would like to know why. As the son of a Missouri Synod pastor, I have to tell you that I take the Bible literally. That is my heritage, and the main reason is because the Bible is a lot more fun if you take it literally. It gives a lot of leeway, but there's always some foolish business to contend with. And when it starts right off the bat, it says in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. My first question is why? I haven't any idea why God would do that. And if any of you have some notion of what possessed God to go into this activity in the first place, I would sure like to know. If we talk about it from the point of view of art, God, in her almighty wisdom, would have known right from the beginning that the birth of that first star was going to end up in the death of the Son of God. Because there is one sure thing we know in any creative process, visual, verbal, or whatever. There is just incredible vulnerability. I mean, to stand up last night and read your poetry, whew, God bless it. But you lay it all out there, right in front of everybody. And some of them, some folks will take it, some folks will reject it, and the real dummies will just simply ignore it. But it makes you incredibly vulnerable. So God had to know that this would do it. But the next question is, I also have problems with this 7 days and a week of creation business. Mainly because there's some time in there that isn't accounted for. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth was without form and void. And then creation starts, and God said, let there be light. And I want to know how long the earth was without form and void before God said, let there be light. Must have been a lot of time in there, and I think what was happening is that God started off and it was kind of messy. It was kind of chaotic, and God wasn't sure whether he wanted to keep going or not. Because creativity is a mess. It is really a mess. you women know more about it than us men, simply because you know more about birthing, and I'm sure you can verify the messy part of that. It's ugly, it's pretty yucky, and it's quite painful, and it makes you very vulnerable. Well, my second question is, why so much? I mean, somebody once said that if you walked out on a black night and saw one star, it would be enough to convince you of a higher power. So all these other things are unnecessary. One is plenty. The rest is extravagance. And the extravagance of God is just not to be believed. Check it out as you walk to and from Heart Lake tomorrow. Just the extravagance. Two fawns would have been enough. One fawn would have been just wonderful. I think Mama's down there trying to figure out what to do with all three. That's going to be a heartache, you know. Just too much going on. Just one would really be plenty. And even if we get it down to our own little world, there is so much going on that it is hard even to classify it. And it goes on every day. The incredible part of God as artist is that the work of art keeps going, it's new every morning, including the folks part. I think they figured out that the United States is growing by 50 square yards every day because of the lava that flows from Kilauea out into the ocean and extends the coastline of the big island of Hawaii. But even the boat ride up Lake Chelan will tell you an awful lot about this variation of water and sky and land and mountain. Unbelievable. We just got back from taking a hike down into the Grand Canyon, and I just wish there wasn't so much, so that I could at least seem a bit intelligent about the things that are there. But there is so much to see. Every time you turn a corner of a canyon wall, a whole new vista opens up. And there were six of us on that trail, and six people saw six different things every time. All seeing different. We lived for a couple years in Uganda during the reign of Idi Amin, and it was a paradise. Born and raised in the slums of St. Louis, I was not big on flora and fauna, but living for that time in Uganda changed all of that. And we couldn't keep track. All we could do was kind of stand in awe of it. If you want to start out a little earlier tomorrow, you could go past Heart Lake and head over towards Image Lake with Glacier Peak in the background. Now, if I were God, don't we do this a lot? If I were God, I would put this at a major intersection. I would not have designed this so that you have to work so hard to get to it. I mean, it's impossible. It's really no fun. It hurts getting there and back, and it's really a great shot. I mean, I sit there and I sing How Great Thou Art when I sit. Now, wouldn't it make sense? God must have had a bad PR person or something. Wouldn't it have made better sense to put all this pretty stuff at the major crossroads, but instead we got all this traffic and smokestacks and things like that at major intersections? Golden arches and ugly stuff. And this is what we should have at the major intersections, but God chose to make them inaccessible. This is on the campus of Makerere University in Uganda, the bottle brush tree, obviously named for good reason, and we used it for that. We had a little baby at the time over there, and we cleaned out the bottles with these beautiful flowers. And even the rocks under your feet, you slice them up and you put them under polarized light and take a picture of them, and this is what you get. Or this, no two alike. This is dirt, folks. These are just rocks. Every speck of creation is charged with some incredible imagination. And God and God says, it's good. So he makes the birds and the plants. And God says, it's good. What does that mean? Why did God say it's good? Saw that it was good. What does that mean? Theologically good? Excellent design? Some of these things I'm going to show you are not excellent design. They're rather ridiculous. So what is good? There is another Old Testament word that might explain the good that God saw. It's delight. And God delighted. I think the stuff just simply turned God on, made God happy. And God liked it. This little kingfisher hovers over the Nile River in Uganda and dives for insects. And when it dives, it leaves a trail of sparks. And I could never understand what T.S. Eliot was talking about the bird that left the sparks until I saw the kingfisher and knew that he must have seen one of these things in Uganda. See that little fluorescent thing on the top knot, on the very top? It's got little lights in it. Yeah, those are light emitting diodes. And when it dives, it just shoots these little things out. I was talking to you about this, some of you up in the dining hall, reminding me of the fawn. This isn't a fawn. This is a full-grown deer. It's a dik-dik, and it is 10 inches tall. It's the smallest of all the antelopes. And God said, I like it. Let's do something else. Let's make something else. Oh, babies are all cute. I think God also invented telephoto lenses. I'm really thankful to God for telephoto lenses. Beasts, huge, ugly. What was the good that God saw in this? I think he saw that not the whole world was not elephants, and that was good. Let's try this for a change. Or these. You want to see something ridiculous. Now only God could have come up with this design. This is one of my all-time favorite things in the whole world. And I don't understand it, and I don't know what the good is, other than that it's funny. This is a ton of lard sitting on four wastebaskets. Its head is like a huge glandular condition, and that whole thing is balanced at the other end by what looks very much like a cigar sticking out the rear end of this animal. And that is there because if that little tail wasn't at the other end, this animal's head would just simply plow into the dirt, you know, it just tip right over. So we like the tail. The tail is also for another reason. There's no way to say this gently. When a hippopotamus is getting ready to defecate, all right, are you with me? The tail revs up. It starts twirling. I mean, like a little propeller. It actually does. And you go, and you know when the tail starts revving up that it's time to be somewhere else. And then it does its duty. And it's where the expression "hit the fan" comes from, because I mean, it just broadcasts all over East Africa, and it has this little smile on its face, you know, while While out the backside, everything is going in all directions. And you can do nothing, absolutely nothing, but stand there and look at that and just get sick to your stomach from laughter. It is the funniest thing you have ever, unless you're too close, of course. And God said, it is good. Compared to what? It's its own reason for being. And I guess I think this had to be good in God's eyes because it made God laugh. It was delightful. Let's make something else. Oh my goodness. We were tracking this thing down in East Africa and came across it just as we got a flat tire. In our Volkswagen van, right in the middle of the bush, we did some really stupid things. I'll tell you, that was the fastest tire I have ever changed. Incredible variety. And then God said, let's make people. Let's make folks. But this time something special. Let's make folks in our image. Now see, up until the time God says, let's make folks in our image, what do we know about God? That would give us a clue as to what God's image is. Well, we know that God was extravagant. We know that God was creative, incredible variety. We know that God had a delicious sense of humor. We know that God's creativity and imagination ran the gamut from the greatest to the smallest, from the simplest to the most complex, and that the things that were created were designed to change every day. Every day a different view. And then God said, let us make folks. And kept it up. I mean, all of these images came out with incredible variety. All kinds of images. So I understand, just from the creation narrative, that if we are to be in the image of God, we are to be delightful. Our job is to make God happy. Our job is to make God laugh. Our job is to be as imaginative as we are obedient. Our job is to be creative. And I think at the heart of the fall, why we lost the image of God was because we stopped being creative. The temptation in the garden was a temptation to be like something else, which meant don't be like what you are created to be. It's the sin of Jonathan Livingston Seagull. Don't take delight in your gullness. See whether you can't be a jet plane or an eagle. To be creative is to be the most you can be. To be in God's image is to be the most human you can be. And I would suspect that there is no such thing as an uncreative Christian. That is an oxymoron. You know oxymorons? Have you heard of those? They're funny. Oxymorons, that's a two-word phrase in which the two phrases contradict each other. Like airplane food or military intelligence. They just contradict each other. Creative Christian. Can't be.
It contradicts itself to be in the image of God. To be in the image of God's Son, little Christ, is to be fully human. And the Christian Church, from its beginnings to now, have understood and tried to do that. I love that. Little pygmy friends in Central Africa and my Holden friends out on the green, all taking delight in their humanity. Well, how do we do that with art? First, it's making stuff with what you know. It's not trying to find a religious art language. I'll tell you frankly, if you want to see the worst art, not just religious art, go to a Christian bookstore. Absolutely the worst. The pits. If you want to become a Christian artist in our day, it's very easy. You learn to make a rainbow and a butterfly and a dove, which looks more like a pigeon. Those three things, and you are in business. You can tack those things onto any Bible passage and it will work. You can make a banner for any season and it will work. The end result is easy and kitsch and cliche and sad. And our bookstores are full of it. Absolute junk. Somehow, in order to be a Christian artist, we have thought that that would make the art easier. But being an artist is hard. Being a Christian is hard. Being both of those things is twice hard, not half hard. Difficult. You cannot have Christian art without art. Much less Christian. And the requirement of art is to make out of what you know, out of what you experience. Suzanne said this a lot very well, but he was kind of funny and said some really strange things. But he said, you can't paint an apple unless you know apple. That's having a physical relationship with an apple. Know it that well. See it that hard. Now say you are a Roman and you know you've got a whole pantheon of gods, and now comes this new god. And you are asked as a sculptor to design a tomb that has this god, this Jesus. There's only one way you can do it. He's got Jesus up there at the top on the throne of heaven looking very much like Apollo. Very much. Because that's how that artist's language described God. So Jesus in a toga, a beardless youth like an Apollo, sitting on a throne in heaven. How is that throne going to be held up in heaven except Zeus holds it up on his blanket, which is the sky? So here we have two languages coming to bear on one subject. And it's honest because it struggles with the foolishness of the Christian faith. For the early Christian, the place where special things were done was very important. You know, like Helen, the mother of Constantine, went around looking for all these sacred spots. The one true kitchen cupboard of Mary in Nazareth, the woman at the well thing, let's find that well, and all these special sites. And then they would build churches over them. This is where Jesus, according to pious tradition, is supposed to have said, Thou art Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church. and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. You can argue about the exegetics of this. My main problem is what the altar guild does when it's time to vacuum the chancel floor. That just must be murder on a vacuum cleaner. But that's the rock, according to pious tradition. And we say, boy, is that ever ridiculous. You know why we say it's ridiculous? Because we don't have much of a sense of place. See, this is the Middle East. This is the land where Psalms were written that talk about the heavens laughing, the mountains leaping and clapping their hands, the earth given all kinds of human attributes. And for the early Christians, the earth was important as a witness to the activity of God. The earth, this rock, witnessed an event in which Jesus took part. And so they honor the earth. They had such a sense of place. That's why they are fighting over that little piece of land in the Middle East. That's why they are fighting, because they have a sense of place and a sense of home. The more you spend out west this summer, the more you realize that a lot of people's homes consist of whatever you can stick on top of six wheels and put a big W on the front of it and a steering wheel inside and take that home wherever you want. And it's got a porta potty and a color TV, and you go into Yosemite and park it next to 5,000 other homes just like it. Oh, you gotta love this. You gotta love this. In the Far East, they said everything gets bigger as it goes away. In the West, everything gets smaller as it goes away. Two different kinds of perspective. This was done in Constantinople, which is a town which is half in the East and half in the West. Half of the city is in Europe, but half of it is in Asia. Okay? So two great art styles come to bear. And here is Jesus Christ in a Roman toga with a Greek hairdo, almond eyes, and a mandarin mustache, looking very oriental here. Everything is west except this which is east, and the book gets bigger as it goes away from us. It's an oriental perspective. And east and west met. In other words, the language was appropriate to the place. The church was accustomed to doing this kind of thing with its architecture. In the Midwest, where I grew up, you could tell a Roman Catholic church from a Lutheran church, and the Episcopal churches all had red doors and were usually made out of stone. But out here, all the churches look like chiropractic offices. All of them. No matter what denomination, they all look kind of the same, except those that are imported in their architecture from the Midwest or the East. Oh, you just... This is so funny. This is so delightful. This was a time of pilgrimage. Okay? People were on the move. So the art form was not big architecture. It was the book, the portable arts. And here's a guy. This guy is from Persia. Islamic, this fellow. Islamic, that's right. And he was part of a culture that was going to invade Europe by going right through Byzantium, but Byzantium stopped him, and so they had to go across North Africa and go then across Spain and then up into France. They got stopped by Charles Martel at Poitiers, okay? Well, this guy got only as far as Spain, and he got converted. Here is an Islamic artist who is not allowed to make images because his faith prohibits it. But he is now converted by Spanish Christians, and now he can't help but make images, but he doesn't quite know how. So he goes back to his Islamic roots, and his Islamic roots are carpets. So he makes a carpet. It's a carpet out of the Last Judgment. It's a prayer rug. And Islamic art form is essentially pattern. So he gets himself a hair stamp. And he goes, Everybody's got the same little rug on top of their head. And he's got an eye stamp, a nose stamp, a mouth stamp. We can tell who Jesus is because he hasn't been exactly stamped out like the rest of the guys. You know, Jesus, I mean, scope out that right hand of Jesus. My goodness, it's like one of those highlight baskets. Incredible. To get smote by this hand would be an eternal experience. And he's got Adidas. He's got... Jesus has got jogging shoes. He is the great strider across the heavens, while all the other guys got black shoes. And in fact, this guy got on a roll with his little black shoe stamp, and he's got one too many feet down there. You got to love this. The guy could not help it. But he didn't go and say, hey, what's meet, right, and salutary for Christian art? He said, it's out of my language, and that's good enough. It's the way I speak. We are supposed to give accounts in our language with what we know to be true.
There was a great time.
Oh, the year 1000 came and went. And everybody thought the world was going to come to an end. The year 2000 is going to be very interesting. It's going to happen then too. But it was more so with the 1000 because of the millennium. And everybody thought, you know, let's, around 996, let's not go into any big building programs. You know, no point in getting a 35-year mortgage on a project that's going to go, you know, down the tubes in 4 years. So everything came to a screeching halt. Everything stopped. And then in the year 1004, I mean, I guess they were sitting around, they weren't quite sure whether their calendar and God's calendar were the same calendar. You know, well, you can count on that. But they thought, well, we'll give them 4 years. Year 1004 came, and these churches started springing up in Europe like mushrooms. I mean, just thousands of them, and they weren't just churches. They weren't like your corner little chapel. These were abbeys, whole communities, self-contained communities, housing hundreds and hundreds of people. And they became the centers of learning. But it was still the age of judgment. I mean, and you know, the people, what they put on the front of those churches, those abbey churches, were like, well, you know, like ghoulies and ghosties and long-leggedy beasties and things going bump in the night. They had them. I think they were literally, excuse the expression, I mean it literally, I think they were trying to scare the hell out of people with what they put on the front of churches. This guy, for example, is going to spend eternal life here having devils pull his tongue out with pliers. It's like spending eternal life in the dentist's office. Makes you want to live long, you know, and brush your teeth. Well, that's what they were saying. He was a liar in his lifetime, and that's his punishment. This is a smaller slide than the others. I cropped it because that dog down there in the lower right-hand corner is doing something that you don't show that to polite society. It's disgusting, and it's right there on the front of the church. Judgment. It's going to be hell unless you repent. But of course, the Passover, that judgment passing, the angel flying over and not putting an end to everything, caused art to come forth in a variety of ways, not just the penitential and the heavy law stuff like this, but some other stuff as well like this. Oh my goodness sakes, this is the Holy Family on the flight to Egypt. And Joseph is singing a song. He's singing a canticle. He's got a sword over his shoulder, but he's singing. I mean, they've escaped Herod. Mary is perfectly content. Mary is pondering in her heart. She's still pondering here. The baby is happy. That's no way to carry a baby when you're on a donkey. But Mary and the baby are okay. The donkey is very happy. The donkey is delighted, and the main reason is that the sculptor has given it wheels. And so the Holy Family is trucking on down to Cairo, and their way has been made easy by the artist. How about three wise men in bed together? You can tell they are wise men because they went to bed with their crowns on. Can you imagine going to bed with two other guys and banging crowns around in bed? Really ridiculous. But even more funny is that in the middle of the night, the one wise guy has his arm outside the covers, and in the middle of the night, the angel of the Lord starts messing with his little finger. Just pretend now you're in bed with two other, all right. And you got your hand outside the cover, and in the middle of the night, somebody starts playing with your finger. Wait a minute. This is beautifully designed. You read a painting from left to right, a work of art, if you're in the Western tradition. So here we go. Look at this. He is wide awake. But he is not moving a muscle. It's like, hey, Balthazar, be cool. Oh, that is so funny. That is so delightful and funny. But that's not the funniest part. The funniest part is, of course, that this is where they are. They're 75 feet up in the air and you can't see them. They're way up here. They are not intended to be shown like in an exhibit. They are intended to be like prayers. You know why that seems so ridiculous to us? Because if we were going to donate a work of art to a church, we'd want that puppy right down there at eye level, right where everybody could see it, with a huge bronze plaque underneath saying who gave it and for whose memory. And I'll tell you frankly, it's true that I probably do more remodeling of churches than building of new ones. And the hardest thing to do in remodeling is to bypass those bronze plaques. It is easier in many churches to get rid of your pastor than to get rid of your candelabra. It is. It is. It gives a whole new definition to the word gift. Oh, funny stuff. Funny, funny. See this chapel in the lower left-hand corner? Check out the third step. That's a 12-foot drop. You got five steps at the bottom, then a 12-foot step, and then three steps at the top. And it's not like you couldn't have enough room. You could have ramped that sucker. Brought it all the way out here. But there was no point, since the chapel was only 18 inches deep and the door didn't open all the way anyway. Now, our question for those people is, why, whatever possessed you, why are you so stupid, or why did you waste so much money for no purpose at all? Our real question should be, what do they know that we don't know? What did they know? These people weren't stupid. That building is standing almost with no repairs having been done since it was built in the 1200s. They were incredible builders, just amazing masons. They were not stupid. There was a reason for what they did, and I think part of it was delight. At least I wish I had had that building committee to work with rather than some of the stumps I got. I am not. Have any of you been on a church building committee? Anybody? You have. Okay. I'll bet you don't want to go on another one. They can be frightening. the closest thing to purgatory, this side of eternal life. And so for some of them, you know, some of them are really great. I currently sit on 63 of them, 63 building committees. And it's a little scary. I wish I had sat on this building committee. This is funny. You build it. You know what this is. You got salt and pepper shakers to match. You start the church in the middle, and you work toward the outside. That's the way they built the church. These people are like 20 miles from Carrara, the greatest supply of marble in the world. Okay, so they, and any color you want. So they start with a pink and a white. I'm with just the love of the pink and a white. And so we go down here with a pink and a white, and after we get about halfway down, I'm just a fed up over the pink. And so we finish it off in a white. It's not like they ran out of pink. There's scads of pink marble up in Carrara right now. It's just like, blech, with the pink. All right? How about the window blank, window blank, window blank, window blank, window blank, window blank, window blank. There's no reason for that. They could have finished it off. It would have certainly made good sense. Where is this window? It's here. Where it doesn't belong. Now you gotta love that. What were those people thinking? Except, is there any reason why we can't build a church and have fun at the same time? You know, the worst thing about building committees, they are so sober. They are the most serious people you ever met in your life. And my job is to convince them right off the bat that no matter how hard they work, it's going to be wrong. No matter whatever they do, somebody's going to really hate it, you know. And we got, so lighten up. Lighten up and take delight in what you've been asked to do. Even this, well, yeah. If I hadn't shown this to you, and before the slide came on, I said, okay, take a picture of the Last Supper. Put it in your mind. The Last Supper. What is it? This is what it would come out to be, right? This is not the Last Supper. This is not. I don't care what anybody has told you. This is not the Last Supper. This is the last portrait session of Jesus and his disciples. That's what this is. This is just. This is all the guys. They're not eating. They're not eating. They were eating, but they're not now. The table is set all the way around, on all four sides, but the best artist in town has come to do a group portrait. You know, now, if you got the guy coming and he's going to do your portrait, you are certainly not going to have him paint the back of your head. So Jesus says, okay, guys, I'll gather around on this side and do whatever the artist tells you to do. So Leonardo says, okay, I want you 12 guys to break up into four groups of three each. And so he does. He's got that group, and that group. And I want you all to now respond the way I tell you to that Bible passage that where Jesus says, one of you guys is going to betray me. And I want four different emotions. I want disbelief, I want anger, etc., etc. James, do a thing like that. James was not, he didn't do that a lot. But when Leonardo told him to do it, he did it. Okay? Outrageous thing. Where is Judas in this thing? Judas, right here. That's too close. Outrageous thing that Leonardo did. All the Judases in previous Last Suppers, Judas was out the door, or he was all by himself on the other side of the table. Here he is, right up close, next to who? John. Judas and John, right next to each other. John, the one that Jesus loved, and Judas? Oh my goodness. Outrageous. What drama. What novelty. But it isn't the Last Supper. It's more about Leonardo than it is about Jesus. It's an idea. And if we take an art idea and we make it the only solution to our faith object, then what we do is idolatry, folks. We do idolatry. Oh, don't you love this? I hate it. I hate it because he was only 24 when he did it. It's like the pianist who was having trouble playing the piano and his teacher asked him what the problem was, and he says, "Do you realize that when Mozart was my age, he had been dead for 8 years?" You know, that's it can be awful frustrating. The guy was obviously a genius. But look, he's not trying to say anything about Jesus' pain. He's not even trying to say anything about Mary's pain. In fact, this was at a time in the Renaissance where they were talking about old classical Greek and Roman ideas like Stoicism. Mary is Stoic. Look at that. She's not suffering. She's hiding her pain. And she's holding that whole dead weight of her son with one hand. One arm holding that. She could have tea in her left hand. So gentle. Why? How could an artist get away with having her look like she could hold all of this dead weight up with one hand? Well, folks, if she stood up and Jesus stood up next to her, she'd be a head and a half taller. That is a big lady. You see that? That's a little guy she's holding. So we don't talk about this as necessarily realism or even true theology. We talk about it as an artist's own personal response to the gospel. And that can continue. That's mine. I just thought I'd do a laughing Jesus one day. I mean a knockdown laughing Jesus. And there are a couple of pastors that they have a group called Pastors Against Pornography. It's, I guess they refer to it as PAP. But at any rate, they really hate this thing. They think Jesus was sober and stiff all the time. How do we respond in our time? How do we creatively respond? The first way in which we creatively respond to the creation blessings that we have been given is to see things hopefully. One of my favorite saints is Vincent, Saint Vincent of Arles, Vincent van Gogh. And this is a painting of his work boots. And it's like an icon. I don't know of an icon of the Orthodox tradition that is more full of the presence of God than this pair of work boots. The artist is looking at them as though there is a hope sign, a blessing sign. We've got to be hopeful. The surest sign of the presence of God in our lives is hope. And I have only one example. We'll talk more in our sessions to come. But to show you about how this hope and foolishness might work. This congregation in Kentucky asked me to help them do stained glass windows. But they wanted to do them all themselves. Which I don't like. I mean, it's kind of like amateur night in the church basement and... You want to be professional. Besides, these folks were all old. I mean, old. Like 85, 87, 90. And so I thought, oh golly, I just don't want anybody to hurt themselves because cutting glass and soldering and all of that can really be hard. And for 6 months, they just said, hey, you do the designs and we'll have somebody else help us. So I finally relented. And we set up a stained glass studio in their basement. There were 14 little windows down the side. One lady wanted to solder was Anna, who was 84 years old. Anna had Parkinson's. Now picture an 84-year-old lady with Parkinson's and a soldering gun. She was waving this like a conductor's baton, you know, and it was pretty amazing how she managed to get the solder at the right spot. And she said her husband, whenever he got mad at her, always went out to the back shed and soldered something. And he never let her in to show her what he was doing. And so if she was going to help on this project, she was going to solder or she wasn't going to do anything at all. So Anna solders, you know. And every time she hit her finger on the other hand, which she kind of used to stop the gun from going where it shouldn't, you know, she let out this little yodel. Ooh, like that. Ooh. It wasn't anger or even frustration. It was just an acknowledgement that she just burned herself. And somebody would then go over with a cup of water and have Anna dip her finger in it. 14 windows down the one wall with all different kinds of symbols and vines and branches. Very, very simple for reasons we'll point out a little later. And the history of their church. They came over as immigrants originally, and they built a little log cabin. And the second church burned down, so here we got the church on fire. And the third church is the one that we worked in the basement, which had big empty holes in it for windows, and that's what we were doing. Here's a stained glass window about no stained glass windows. You know. Well, they did this. It took 2 years. Not quite 2 years. A year and 10 months. It would have taken me about 3 weeks to do this, but they were having such a good time, and they insisted on installing them as well, building them and installing them. And then they said, "Now let's go for the big one. Now we want to do the big one in the back." And I was up to here. First of all, was just making trips back and forth to Kentucky and helping these folks, and they were still smashing glass at the very end. Hadn't quite caught on to some of the problems, but they were having such a good time, they wanted to go for the big one.